Call this meeting to order. This is Senate Labor and Commerce. Let the record reflect last day of March, Tuesday, March 31st, 2009. Let the record reflect there is a quorum present. To my right, Senator Meyer and Senator Thomas and myself, Senator Pascfan. We have to my left, Senator Bundy joining us. So we do have...
Yep.
Yeah, there. Perfect. Anyway, the purpose of the meeting today is we will first take up the confirmation of the governor's appointments, and then we will follow that with Senate Bill 170 relating to the unemployment amendments as relates to the federal stimulus monies, then Senate Bill 60 relating to the Uniform Probate Code, Trusts and Wills, and then if time permits, we will get to Senate Bill 149 relating to mortgage lending. I would remind everyone here, cell phone, Blackberries, please turn them off so that we do not interfere with the recording equipment or the other equipment here that doesn't like the interference. We did begin hearing last Thursday on the governor's appointments, and if there are no objections, I'd like to move that out of the committee today. After that, again, here, Senate Bill 170, it is my intent I'd like to move that bill today. And then after that, Senate Bill 60 and Senate Bill 149, which we will probably not move out of committee today. Anyway, we will open up to any public testimony. Is there anyone that has called online regarding public testimony on any of the governor's appointments? There's no public testimony. Is there anyone here locally that would like to provide any testimony with respect to the governor's appointments? Does any committee member have any comments or observations with respect to any of the governor's appointments? Hearing none, I believe a motion would be appropriate. First of all, I'll close public hearing on this, as there is no public testimony to be provided. But any questions of any committee members?
The only question I have, do we need to list them by name and or just a blanket?
I think you can do a blanket.
Just a blanket.
Move the motion. Name okay. Submitted.
All right. I would make that motion then that we approve the governor's we confirm the governor's appointments.
Excellent.
And move them.
Actually, Joe, I think we're just moving them to the floor for confirmation.
Yeah, and move them to the floor for confirmation. That's the only place they need to go.
Okay.
That's the motion then.
Okay. Any objections from any committee member? Seeing none, it is so moved. We'll take a brief at ease for signing. The Senate Labor and Commerce Committee back to order, and the record should reflect that Senator Davis had joined us and is now with us for the remainder of this committee hearing. I thank Senator Ellis for appearing before us today. We now have Senate Bill 170 relating to unemployment and the federal stimulus monies. And so if please identify yourself and sponsor statement, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Johnny Ellis, State Senator for Downtown and Midtown Anchorage, Senate District L. And I really appreciate you and your staff and the members of the committee having this bill before you today. It was speedy consideration of the bill, and it's much appreciated. I also have a thank you to send out to the National Federation of Independent Business and the Alaska State Chamber for working with our office to get this bill right and make it as beneficial as possible. So a lot of folks working together to get this done. The bill relates to unemployment insurance and stimulus, as you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, and represents a small change in the UI eligibility standards in the state of Alaska. That's the small change in the UI system that the bill is all about. Many of you know that the state of Alaska is much further ahead many of many other states, in particular southern states, that have very antiquated UI systems. We have modernized our UI system, and the major changes to modernize the system have already been accomplished. We did that of our own volition here in the state of Alaska, and this is one minor change that would bring us great benefits and has no strings attached. We're going to establish for the record that this would be a good thing that everyone can join together in supporting. Senate Bill 170 gives workers, well, first, current eligibility is based on meeting minimum earnings in the first four of previous five completed quarters. Mr. Hensley is here with me to help explain exactly the technical details of how that would work in this legislation. Senate Bill 170 gives workers who do not meet that qualification the option of recalculating using their earnings from the last four completed quarters. Everyone that this change benefits, and it's about 1,300 people is our estimation, would have become eligible for unemployment insurance payments 3 months later. This just eliminates the three-month lag time for a relatively small group of unemployed workers. Approximately 1,300 people and $1.9 million in benefits would have been affected in 2008 had this policy been in place. And the good news, the really good news, besides the fact that we've modernized, we've done most of the modernizing of our UI system already, is that the federal stimulus dollars fully fund this minor change. And it brings in $17 million for job training and to enhance the UI trust fund. If some money is deposited in the UI trust fund and we are working to calculate that exact amount, no impact to business taxes. So that's why National Federation of Independent Business and the State Chamber are not screaming bloody murder. They think this is a good opportunity, and I'll let them speak for themselves. But this is not some kind of threat. It's actually an enhancement. It helps business. It helps the trust fund. It can help unemployed workers. The Department of Labor, NFIB, Representative Hawker's office are taking the lead on the exact amount. And I want to be clear, too, Mr. Chairman, and put on the record that the Department of Labor, I have great admiration for them. They have taken no position on this bill. They have not been involved in the drafting of the bill, but they have answered mine and my staff's questions in a very professional manner. And so I don't want to overstate their involvement in this. They've been very professional and in representing the Palin administration. Representative Hawker, his opinion is that $3 million maximum, between $3 million and $5 million is what should be put in the trust fund to cover these costs and enhance that fund. The UI trust fund is currently solvent, more than solvent, $350 million balance. It's one of the healthiest funds in the country and only requires this slight addition to maintain solvency when balanced against the small additional expense. And the rest of the money can be spent on job training. These are one-time dollars, and of course Alaska is currently facing the highest unemployment in a generation. We expect later this year to feel more of the effects of the national and the worldwide recession, near depression in some places, and so this is a great time with more unemployed workers to help with job training and retraining. We are preparing for the largest infrastructure project in U.S. history. We all remain hopeful that the gas line will come to fruition. We're going to need welders. We're going to need all kinds of folks to get that job done, or even to work in the existing jobs and industry we have today. So there's a confluence of events that gives us a perfect opportunity to use excess federal dollars or federal dollars allocated to Alaska for a targeted and timely expansion of job training. So I'm trying to establish for the record that this is a reasonable act to take. It's a net gain on two or three different levels, and we just need to work our way through the details. in my opinion. This bill comes out of the intent of the legislative leaders in both bodies and both parties to closely examine all available stimulus dollars. That's what we're going through to make sure we know what we're doing, and accept only those which make sense for Alaska in the long term. To quote the National Federation of Independent Business, quote, "This is a relatively simple administrative change, the cost of which will be borne by stimulus funding. That is good for individual Alaskans, employers, and the economy." Couldn't have said it better myself. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the broad outline. If it's okay with you, Mr. Hensley has some technical details to share, and then some answers to frequently answered questions, and then we'd be happy to try and answer any questions that remain.
Thank you, Senator Ellis. Mr. Hensley, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Max Hensley, staff to Senator Ellis. This is a fairly simple bill, but it's in the middle of a relatively complex discussion, so it's important to separate out the changes in Senate Bill 170 from some of the larger stimulus debate. The bill, as the senator said, is one section. It gives unemployed workers the option, if they do not qualify for unemployment insurance based on their earnings, to recalculate them using, rather than the first four quarters of the last five, shifting that up 3 months and using the most recent four completed calendar quarters. And it takes effect on January 1st, 2010. The Department of Labor generally calculates unemployment insurance benefits on a calendar year rather than a fiscal year basis. So it's a relatively simple change, but it has been the subject of a lot of discussion in many parts of the country, here locally and in national media. There's a number of states that are concerned that the unemployment insurance modernization, which actually totals about $7 billion in incentive money as from the federal stimulus nationwide, would require significant expansions to eligibility requirements. The federal stimulus makes the pot of money that is allocated to each state dependent on two sets of criteria. The first third of the money is available to any state that offers this alternative base period, which Alaska currently does not, and which Senate Bill 170 would provide. The second two-thirds are based on a state offering UI benefits to unemployed workers who are members of at least two of the following four categories: part-time workers, workers who are enrolled in training programs, workers who leave their jobs for compelling family reasons, and additional benefits for workers with dependents. As Senator Ellis said, Alaska already meets those final two categories. If we make the initial one-third, if we make the initial change to become eligible for the initial one-third of the money, we will be bumped up to the full pot of money without any further changes. The reason that this has become an issue in many other states is because they need to make all of those changes, which could be substantial. But Alaska's not faced with that problem, and so it's not something we need to worry about. The other question that folks have asked is that an expansion of benefits means, in the long term, an expansion of business taxes, which are what support the unemployment insurance trust fund. It's true that business taxes support the unemployment insurance trust fund. However, Alaska's trust fund is, as the senator previously stated, one of the healthiest in the nation, a balance of about $350 million at the close of 2008. The additional monies in the stimulus are more than enough to cover this small addition in liability. A third major question that many people have asked is whether this change would expose us to a permanent and ongoing liability. There's a two-part answer to this. First, nothing in the stimulus requires states not to change their laws back at some point in the future. There's a provision that says this can't have a sunset clause or be explicitly temporary in the law itself, but the stimulus does not change the federalist division of our government, the constitutional ability of Alaska to make its own laws. There's no clawback provisions, and that was certified in a letter from the Federal Department of Labor recently. Additional money beyond what's necessary to shore up the UI trust fund can be used for increased administration or for job training. The department doesn't feel as though it needs the money for increased administration because it is such a small amount of increased benefits. And as the senator said, the The job training money is especially timely at this point in time because of the economic slowdown that we're facing. The other thing to note about that is that this is a one-time grant. After the money goes into the UI Trust Fund, it can be appropriated by the state without an end date, unlike many other stimulus funds which must be spent over the next year or 2 years. The state could choose to space this money out more widely. That's a policy appropriations call that I don't want to recommend one way or the other, but it does. We do not have to spend it all this year and then face a steep drop off in the future. There's no state match required. This is another question that other folks have brought up. And finally, the question of whether of the impact of this money on the overall federal debt. There's been significant question about whether Alaska should be accepting this money as a responsible member of the United States when the federal government as a whole is facing significant debt. While that is true and it is a concern, nothing that Alaska does in accepting or rejecting stimulus funds can have any impact on that. The funds have already been appropriated by the federal government. Anything we do not accept will be sent to another state to be spent either benefiting their job training or benefiting their unemployed workers. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. But that concludes.
Senator Thomas.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you review the criteria again and just the status Absolutely. Of them versus what we have, what we don't have, and so what would be new?
I'll do it a little slower. I've been over this a number of times, and I realize it's a little bit complicated. There's two pots of money within Alaska's portion of the Unemployment Insurance Modernization Incentive. The first third is contingent on the acceptance of the alternative base period, which is what's outlined in this bill. And the second two-thirds are contingent on the state offering unemployment insurance benefits to at least two of the four categories which I mentioned, which are part-time workers. Alaska does not offer unemployment insurance benefits to part-time workers. Extended benefits to workers who are enrolled in training programs. Well, Alaska does offer benefits to people who are enrolled in training programs. They don't extend them beyond the regular eligibility period, so we do not qualify under that standard. Workers who leave their jobs for, quote, compelling personal reasons, which is what the line from the legislation, that is not in the Alaska statutes, but we do allow workers who leave their jobs for good cause to receive benefits, and that's been ruled by the Federal Department of Labor to meet their criteria. And finally, the expanded benefits for workers who have dependents. And Alaska offers, I believe it's $24 a week extra to workers per dependent. And so we do meet the final two criteria and would not need to change our statutes to conform with this to receive the second two-thirds of the money. However, we cannot receive the second two-thirds unless we receive the first third.
Any further questions of Senator Ellis or Mr. Hensley? Senator Thomas?
I was just wondering a question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are we going to have is the department going to testify whether they're, I realize they may not be in favor one way or another, but are they going to be available to question on the fiscal note or other issues that might arise, or had you not intended to have them, or do they not want to? I don't.
Is there any one that would care to speak to that, at least at the moment? I believe before we call the department up, Senator?
No, I just had a question for the
okay.
department.
Thank you to the two of you. If the representative of the department. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, committee. For the record, my name is Paula Scavera. I'm Special Assistant Legislative Liaison to the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. With me, I have Tom Nelson, who's the Director of Employment Security Division, and Jim Wilson, an economist with the Research and Analysis Section. And those would be the people to ask technical questions.
Senator Bundy.
Well, I have, I suppose, a couple of technical questions if you want to bring your troops up?
I would love to bring my troops up. I would love to bring my associates with me.
And where's Tanana Alice's buddy?
I'm sorry?
And where is Tanana Alice's buddy?
He's back at the office.
So, doesn't care enough to speak to us. Well, I don't know.
If the two of you could please identify who you are and your affiliation, and then Senator Bundy has a question that he may wish to submit.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Nelson. I'm the Employment Security Division Director.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm James Wilson. I'm an economist with the Research and Analysis section of the department.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Mr.
Bundy.
Chairman. Well, first off, if this is a good idea, why didn't the department suggest it earlier? Why haven't Alaska done this already? Before we were bribed by this money.
For the record, Senator Bundy, through the chair, I actually have to plead ignorance. There's many states who have many different programs, and so I'm not really sure the answer. We would have to get back to you on that.
Okay, thank you. If I might continue. I think I understand the program. I'm a little concerned that $2 million is an insignificant cost, but if we make this change, that would be likely an ongoing cost, the extra $2 million, and after the stimulus money goes away, that would be a continuing impact on the program without the stimulus money. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, I'm going to let Tom Nelson, who actually has that program in his division, answer the question.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bundy, we have done some extensive analysis of the cost to the trust fund, and we calculated an actual number of 1,293 individuals that otherwise would have been eligible for benefits in calendar year 2008. And of the $1.9 million cost, 26%, I believe, is borne by the actual worker. So they have also contributed to the cost of these benefits also. And we believe that if $3 million or approximately that would be left in the trust fund, at least the first year, that it would be the rest of the cost in years outgoing would be largely absorbed by our trust fund solvency factor.
Bernie Madoff didn't give you that advice, did he?
Mr. Chairman, Senator
Never
Bundy,
mind.
No.
Okay. My next question, I mean, it's magic. The cost goes away. My next question is there was a discussion that some states have put a sunset on this. I'd just like an opinion from the department as to whether that would be a wise move.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bundy, we already know that 18 states already have this provision long before the stimulus package came out, and some of them did have a sunset provision, to my understanding. And the federal guidance we've received is that they understand the ability of state legislators to change the laws after this is over with, and they only require a certification that we're acting on good faith, and they understand that the laws can be changed in the future.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment. They may not understand the politics of trying to change unemployment benefits and reduce them. Senator Ellis and I have had many, many discussions about changing UI, and it's a difficult thing to change, so I don't know if that's a realistic view. And just one final question. One of the bones of contention have always been when we've discussed changing UI insurance is the fact that in Alaska, workers who are fired for cause, you know, all kinds of whatever, dereliction, they still can claim UI, and this doesn't change that. They will still continue to claim UI insurance even if they're fired for cause.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bundy, that is correct. We do have a quit and fire provision that requires them to go through a six-week waiting period, but they still would be eligible to make claims.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand that the department is neither in favor of or opposes the legislation. Is that accurate?
Department and administration is neutral.
Neutral. Okay. We're in neutral. In that case, the attached fiscal note is the goes out to 2015. Is it anticipated that the federal money lasts that long, or is this a zero fiscal note in the future beyond the point in time when the federal money is gone?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomas, it is a zero fiscal note to the cost of the program, because regardless of how many claims we process throughout a year, if we're above base and our work is counted minutes per unit, and the workload actually dictates what the federal government reimburses us for. So that's one of the reasons why this is a zero fiscal note. And I can't speak to why it only goes out to 2015.
The form goes to 2015, so we just put zeros across.
I see it's the normal form. It only has so many slots.
Yes.
last question, anyhow, is do you agree with the explanation of the first part and or the first third and the second two-thirds as far as what this bill does and the required changes and your existing statute or existing regulations and law?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomas, yes, I do. Senator Ellis's office accurately described the two parts. The first third requires an alternate base period change, and the second two-thirds, we already do meet the requirements of the dependents allowance and the leaving work for good cause. So those two have already been checked out by our federal partners as being compliant with the second two-thirds.
Thank you.
Senator Bundy, you have an additional question?
Yeah, I do. Thank you for your indulgence. I'm just stuck on this idea that it seems like a fairly minor technicality of calculating eligibility. It would have helped 1,300 plus people, but yet the department did not choose to do that. And I'm just curious, would there have been an economic impact if they had chosen to do that?
For the record, Paula Scavera, through the chair, Senator Bundy, that's a statutory change that has to be done by the legislature. And I have only worked at the Department of Labor for 6 years, and I've never heard of that brought up. Prior to that, in previous legislators, I don't know if it was ever brought up or not.
Thank you.
Any additional questions of Mr. Nelson? Did you have an observation?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bundy, I'd also like to point out that I forgot my thought. never mind. I'm sorry.
I have the same feeling from time to time.
Further questions, one last opportunity. Is there anyone online or here locally that would like to provide public testimony as to Senate Bill 170?
Mr. Chairman, I see a representative of FIB here. I'm wondering if we could ask him to comment.
Mr. DeWitt, would you care to move forward one row?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Denny DeWitt. I represent the National Federation of Independent Business. I'd be happy to respond to any questions. Senator Ellis, I think, very well outlined our position. We've worked quite a bit with the department, with various legislators and their staff, and with consultants that NFIB retains in Washington, D.C. on this issue. Probably there weren't many folks screaming louder than we were to be cautious in this area until we were able to unwind all the requirements, particularly whether or not this expanded benefits changed the character of the program and what the impact on premiums would be. We're satisfied that the deposit that we're working with the finance committees, well, as close as we can tell, offset the costs quite a ways into the future in terms of the change in the base period. We've also been assured, both by working with our department and with folks that represent businesses in Washington, D.C. working on this issue, that the character of our program will remain intact in terms of how ongoing benefits are paid, which was, again, one of our biggest concerns.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DeWitt. We appreciate your comments.
I'd like also to thank Senator Ellis, particularly, and their staff. They've been very, very cordial in terms of working with us on this. And I got to tell you, it has been a real a knot to unwind. And I appreciate the help that they've given the business community.
Thank you. Again, anyone online or here present that would like to provide public testimony? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. I guess I would like to make an observation that I think that this is the type of bill that does deserve the support of this committee. I think it helps the unemployed at a time that they probably are going to need help, and that with the business community supporting this as well, I think it's the right bill at the right time, and it should advance from this committee. So I would appreciate a motion. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that Senate Bill 170 version /E be moved to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. We will be at brief at ease for signing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Back to order. Mr. Fulton, I believe it's your stage, so if you would please come forward. And we are now addressing Senate Bill 60 relating to the Uniform Probate Code, an area that even many lawyers like to fall asleep listening to.
Thank you for the rousing introduction, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Trevor Fulton. I'm staff for Senator Lisa McGuire, the sponsor of Senate Bill 60. She would be here herself. She still may join us momentarily for the time being. I hope I'll be able to explain the bill well enough for you. Senate Bill 60's short title is Uniform Probate Code, Trusts, and Wills. Now, since not everyone has a firm understanding of these terms, myself included, before doing my homework for this bill, I hope you don't mind if I take a few moments to go over a couple of basics, particularly for those who are listening at home. Probate is the legal process in which a will is reviewed to determine whether it is valid and authentic. Probate also refers to the general administering of a deceased person's will or the estate of a deceased person without a will. I think it's safe to say that we've all got a good idea what a will is. A trust is similar to a will with one very important distinction. With a trust, your property won't go through probate when you die. With a will, during probate, much of the estate is taken by taxes, mostly federal, and sometimes attorneys. When you create a trust, you transfer your properties and assets to it while you're still alive, and it continues on through your death and thus does not need to go through the same costly legal proceedings that a will does. Senate Bill 60 deals specifically with trusts and the Uniform Probate Code by clarifying, updating, and adding to existing Alaskan probate laws with the aim of, one, improving the ease of administration of wills, estates, and trusts for Alaskan residents, and two, with the aim of making Alaska a more attractive place to do trust business. Now, most of these changes involve either clarifying language or omitting unnecessary verbiage. Other changes include clarifying issues related to representation of an incapacitated person, clarifying property transfers involving a deceased spouse, creating a procedure for the establishment of will and trust validity before death, and addressing the venue of a probate proceeding if a decedent lives outside of Alaska but held significant assets within the state. These changes were brought to us by experts in the probate and trust field, and we have not received any negative feedback on the changes made by Senate Bill 60. The trust business is a highly competitive, multi-billion dollar sector that often crosses state lines in order to take advantage of more attractive state trust laws. Senate Bill 60 makes Alaska a more attractive place to do trust business, and by doing so, creates jobs and revenue that would otherwise go outside. The state of Alaska has directly received millions of dollars in tax revenue, and many Alaskan jobs have been created in trust, banking, insurance, and legal professions, thanks to the business generated by our competitive and contemporary trust laws. Senate Bill 60 is part of an ongoing effort to modernize our trust laws, and by doing so, one, to create jobs and revenue, and two, to diversify our economy, and finally, three, to make Alaska as attractive to trust business and investment as Delaware is to credit card and banking business. I again thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 60, and would be happy to answer any questions, with one caveat added, and that being that just so I don't confound the questions that are being asked or the person who's asking the questions, I do have several trust experts online who I will probably be lobbying the occasional, if not most, of these questions to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions of committee members of Mr. Fulton? Seeing none, I know that we do have a number of persons who have signed up to testify, so if you are comfortable, you can remain there while we is there a David Sheftel? David Sheftel?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Please identify yourself, state your affiliation, and provide your testimony.
Yes, I'm an attorney in private practice. I work in the estate planning and estate and trust administration area. I'm a member of an informal group of attorneys and trust officers who have worked with the Alaska legislature since 1997 to improve our Alaska's estate and trust statutes. I've worked on Senate Bill 60. And I'm relatively familiar with all of its provisions. Worked with legislative affairs on trying to improve the drafting of these provisions. To summarize, we go through the particular changes that this bill accomplishes. Section 1 allows a person who creates a trust to designate a person, a representative, can represent incapacitated persons, and for example, that settlor's family or the beneficiaries of the trust that settlor has created. These incapacitated persons can be minor children. They can be unborn children who would have rights to trust assets down the line. Or they might be somebody who is an adult but is incapacitated and cannot really represent himself or herself. So this allows, let's say, for example, Mr. Chairman, you were to create a trust, you could designate an individual who you would want to represent these incapacitated persons if matters came up in the future that needed to be heard by a court or needed to be agreed to by all the beneficiaries of the trust. This is a provision that was first drafted into Florida's laws several years ago, and we saw it, and it seemed to be a very valuable provision, so we're suggesting it here to the legislature. Section 2 creates just a typo in existing law. Sections 3 and 4 update Alaska's law. As Mr. Fulton pointed out in his very able introduction, this is a competitive industry. We have noticed that Delaware and New Hampshire have filled a gap that existed in our law, one that quite frankly we forgot to cover, dealing with an irrevocable trust that's created by a settlor. Alaska was the first state that created this kind of trust, where a settlor could create a trust. It would be irrevocable. The settlor could be a discretionary beneficiary of that trust, and the settlor's creditors couldn't reach the assets in the trust. Now, this is done well before the settlor has any claims against him. It would not be done to defraud any creditors, but you could create a trust when you don't have any claims against you, and then in the future, if one came up, the assets in this type of trust wouldn't be subject to that settlor's creditors. One of the things that the other state's laws and our state law covers is during lifetime, if you do this with your spouse's consent or before you marry, then your spouse has no claims against the assets in that trust. What we forgot to do was to cover there's a provision in the state trust laws that says that a spouse can elect against the decedent's assets and the decedent's probate estate and trust created by the decedent. We forgot to cover it in that provision as well. So this is a conforming provision that brings our law into par with Delaware and New Hampshire's new laws. Sections 5, 6, and 7 of the bill just change sites. Those are just technical provisions. Section 8 is a very interesting, and to those of us who work in this area, believe it or not, we stay awake when we're working in it, this is an exciting provision. This provision allows a person who has drafted a will or a trust to have that will or trust validated while the person is alive. And so to foreclose challenges after the person dies, where a beneficiary or someone else might come in, or somebody who was left out might come in and challenge that will or trust due to arguments that the person who created it was incapacitated, or there was undue influence or duress or fraud or similar claim. So this allows a person to go in, again, Mr. Chairman, using you as an example, you draft a will and you're worried that one of your heirs might say that you were incapacitated, or that another one of your family members unduly influenced you to put a certain provision in that will. So you can go into court, notice everybody up, and have a proceeding. And anybody who wants to object can object then, but that's while you're around, and you can respond to those objections. And then the court can rule. The court can rule, no, this was validly created will, and there was no undue influence, there was no fraud, no duress, and the person who created it had capacity. We think this is very valuable. Three or four other states have statutes somewhat like this, but not anywhere near as well written as this provision. So we think this will be an excellent addition to Alaska's state and trust laws, be very valuable for the residents of the state of Alaska. All of us who practice in this area see these kinds of situations periodically. Section 9 provides a venue provision, just updates our venue statute, for the probate of a will of a person who's not a resident of Alaska at the time when they died. Examples include people who move out of Alaska and, you know, happen to be residing in Palm Desert or Phoenix or some other place that perhaps is a little warmer, as well as other non-residents of Alaska. Sections 10 and 11 allow a fiduciary, a personal representative or a trustee, to consider discretionary distributions as coming from capital gain. And this is really a tax planning provision that will result in better tax planning for beneficiaries of estates and trusts, because it'll lower the tax, the overall tax consequences of a distribution. So that is a brief summary of this bill. We've worked on it diligently. We think we have all the bugs out of it. There's a number of people have provided input into it. It's one of three bills, really four bills, relating to the estate and trust law. There were three that our group worked on with the staff and legislative affairs and that are before your legislature this session. There's a carryover bill dealing with Disclaimer of Interest Act, the Uniform Disclaimer of Interest Act, that also is before the pending. I don't think if it's been reintroduced, but it was introduced last session, and we've worked on it and made a lot of changes to it, and we think that's a very good bill as well. I highly recommend all of these bills for your consideration. I think that they will provide significant improvements to our Alaska estate and trust laws.
Senator Bundy has a question for you, Mr. Schaftel.
Yeah, thank you. Maybe just a clarification. Perhaps I misunderstood. As you were listing the various sections in Section 2, I think I heard you say that the changes created a typo, and I'm not sure that we want to do that.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, no, there was an existing typo when we were going over the statute.
So it corrects the typo
that already was in the law.
Yeah, it corrects a typo. It does not create one.
Yes, and forgive me if I misstated that.
No, well, I may have misunderstood. Thank you.
I have one question, and it relates to the irrevocable trust and the discretionary beneficiary. Is this to lessen the need for prenuptial agreements? In other words, is that what it's intending upon accomplishing?
Chairman, yes, that is one function of this type of a trust, or one of the functions this type of trust can serve. We do use a lot of prenuptial agreements, but let's say that you were single at this point, but were thinking about marrying, and you had certain assets that you wanted to make sure would not be subject to divorce down the line. Now, then you could create this type of a trust if you create it prior to 30 days prior to marriage. Then it would not be subject to division at divorce or at death, or you could even do it after marriage if your spouse consented to it. And we find that there are postnuptial agreements that occur after marriage.
My next question is this an intent to have Alaska be a nation's leader in attracting from other jurisdictions people that want to deposit their assets in these type of irrevocable trust documents, or is this for Alaskans' needs?
Chairman, I can tell you that in my practice, in our practice, is most of our clients are called medium and large estates, almost all of our clients take advantage of this kind of trust, which is called the self-settled discretionary spendthrift trust. So many Alaskans are using it, but it also has been an attraction for non-residents of Alaska who want to use this kind of trust. At this time, though, when Alaska innovated this law, which was back in 1997, we were really the first state that had a usable statute allowing for this kind of trust. Now there are 12 states, and these states are all over the country. They're in the East Coast, they're in the Midwest, and they're in the West Coast. So we are no longer the only one. Some people do come to Alaska. We hope more will. That is certainly a financial benefit to the state, and it's significant, but these types of trusts are used, in our office at least, primarily for residents of Alaska.
And if you could provide a definition of medium and large clients, I think their asset values, just so I have an understanding of the range of money that you're talking about.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. In our office, at least, we've defined medium estates as starting with estates that are larger than the applicable credit amount. And that amount has been increasing over the years, and right now it's a very topical amount in the federal Congress. It's $3.5 million in 2009. It was $2 million last year, and it's been creeping up from $1 million since 2001. The talk in the street, as they say, is that it probably is going to stay at $3.5 million and will be indexed in the future. But we're all waiting and watching Congress to see what they're going to do about this. But that's what most people are anticipating.
So that's medium, and then the definition of large?
Large would be anything over that, probably starting over twice that amount, because typically a married couple, can protect twice that credit amount. So in the past, if it was $1 million, they could protect $2 million. Now, where it's $3.5 million, a married couple will be able to protect $7 million. So large, at least in our office, would be over twice that amount, and then on up.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Schaftel. Any other questions of Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the venue section, are we saying there that the will or the trust, it says only will there, so does it cover trust as well?
This particular provision, which is Section 9 of the work draft, in subsection B, that's only dealing with wills. There also is a venue provision, though, dealing with that the pre-mortem proceedings that I described before, dealing with validating a will or trust. And there's a venue provision there also. Were you thinking of Section 9?
I was looking at Section 8, and it does have two areas. It does mention trust in the next, but I just wanted to make sure that it covered both wills and trusts. And the real question I get, I guess, is that if in fact in the will or the trust itself, it obviously has to express and direct and authorize that the original probate or decision-making process or court proceedings, whatever it might be, would take place in a particular state that may not be the person's residence. And if that is the case, what happens to, say, the state of California, the example you used, Palm Desert, California, that the state of California had similar laws and required that all people residing in their state, regardless of the term, such a term of a will or a trust, would be settled in that state.
Representative Thomas, and through the chair, I see which provision you're looking at. Let me answer your first question, that you're looking at Section 8, which deals with what we call the pre-mortem proceedings, and that does cover venue for both a will and for a trust. So it refers to Section 530 and Section 535, and one is for a will and the other is for a trust. The second question you ask, is an interesting one. I'm not aware of a state that certainly states, and you probably recall Howard Hughes' estate, mm-hmm. where a number of states fought over the right to tax right. Howard Hughes' property, and that was a very famous case that ultimately a bunch of states worked out an agreement and they divided up the state taxing power. But I'm not aware of any state having a statute that says that if you reside in this state, your estate must be probated here, rather that allows the estate to be probated here. If you had a conflict like that among states, there is a whole area of the law that called conflict of laws. And we'd have to refer to that and look at the statutes of both states. And then there are principles established by this area of law that would hopefully guide us to the proper conclusion.
Okay, thank you.
That raises one additional question under the venue section. So a non-domiciled or non-resident of Alaska can, in the document itself, establish Alaska as the venue for resolution of these trust and will issues. Is that accurate?
That's correct. Now, what would happen with the provision that Representative Thomas was asking about, which is Section 8, which is this new provision which allows for establishment of the validity of a will or trust before death, what we anticipate there is that the person who has created that document, if they weren't a resident of Alaska, they would come to Alaska for the proceeding. And they would file a proceeding here, and it would be before our courts, and our courts would then have them before the court and have jurisdiction over them, and venue would be as indicated in Section 540 of the bill.
My question is really focused upon the cost to the court system. In other words, is that overwhelmed, so to speak, by the income that the state receives elsewhere? In other words, if all of a sudden this is Alaska's going to be the place where wills are going to be contested, or these procedures are going to be started, or trust documents, in other words, is this going to be a tremendous cost to the court system that is more than the amount of money that the state might receive in taxation of these trusts?
Mr. Chairman, I can only give you an opinion on that. As I mentioned, there are four other states that have processes that are similar to this. So it's not as if we are going to have a monopoly on this. And my own opinion is, based upon watching these laws for the past 12 years, is that this particular statute is novel in that it's written very well. A lot of people had very good input into it. I think it'll be copied rather rapidly by a number of other states. I think this provision will serve Alaska residents, and it will serve some people who decide that they're going to choose that Alaska will be the state where they want this proceeding to occur. Keep in mind, I mean, when you say a tremendous cost, we're also, a lot of people view us as being a tremendous distance away. And I would think that people are going to go to other states that are closer. Some people will come up here. That will be an advantage to us in terms of both the professions that get involved in the process, and that cost, I think, will at least match and probably be significantly greater than the cost of the court system.
Senator Bundy had a question for you.
Well, it's not a question, it's a comment to you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to make you nervous, but my mind is going down a parallel track with you, and that is, I'm always concerned about the, you can always have the option to change your mind. I'm always concerned about the net gain to the state. And in the sponsor statement, there was some discussion of how much money this trust haven we've created up here is making. And I know the fiscal note is zero as cost to the state. But it would be of interest to me if we had someone from the Department of Revenue that give us a ballpark figure as to what is the state making off this whole trust arena. I had quoted a document to you before that has been produced showing in tourism, timber, mining, and one other item, and what was the net return to the state in those arenas. It'd be just, out of, I suppose, curiosity. It'd be interesting to know what the net return is. Do we have anybody from the Department of Revenue available?
I don't believe so, but...
I understand this isn't finance, but labor and commerce probably should involve whether we make money or not.
Mr. Chairman, if I could comment a little
yes.
bit more on this?
Sure.
I don't want to leave you with the wrong impression. The trust and estate statutes that we've been working on over 12 years and that the legislature has improved tremendously, the primary benefit that I see, and this is the only area of law that I practice in, and I've been at this for well over 35 years, these provisions primarily benefit Alaskans. Every time you approve one of these changes that comes through, Alaska residents are the primary beneficiaries, in my view, in my practice, and the attorneys who I talk to in Alaska who work in this area, that most of our clients are Alaskans, and all of them really benefit from these changes, and as a result, this is probably the best state to live in terms of having good estate and trust laws. Now, also, they've been made available to persons who are non-residents, and that has brought in revenue, but it in comparison, if you were to look at the total overall benefits, the benefits to Alaska residents greatly exceed those to non-residents of Alaska using our laws in this area.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schaftel. There's a question by Senator Thomas.
Just a last question to make sure I either understand or don't understand. The aspect of the venue, is that available to people that own or have no assets in the state of Alaska but simply want their will probated or the procedures to whatever process needs to be gone through done in the state of Alaska?
Representative Thomas, through the chair, yes, it would be available to non-residents of Alaska just as our trust law is available to non-residents of Alaska. The restatement of trusts, for example, makes it clear that a person can choose what state's trust law they want to have apply to their trust. And so there, as Mr. Fulton pointed out in his introduction, there is a lot of crossing of state lines by individuals using state and trust laws.
Okay, thank you.
We have, thank you, Mr. Schaftel. I believe that is all of the questions of the committee as to your testimony. We thank you for that. Now there are three people from Alaska USA Trusts, Douglas Blotmacher, Jim Plymire, and Janet Temple. Do you all three wish to testify, or is there, we're pleased to do that if you have, what's your preference?
Chairman, this is Douglas Blotmacher from Alaska Trust Company. The other two individuals, one is from Wells Fargo, and the other is from Alaska USA Trust Company.
Okay.
Alaska USA Trust Company and Alaska Trust Company are two different entities. And I just like to say that we support this piece of legislation. We think it'll be good for trust businesses and help Alaska. And I'm available for any questions you might have.
All right, any questions of the committee? Are there any comments that you have to any of the questions asked of Mr. Schaftel?
Chairman, the only answer I have is that we know from the business that we have done that the state has received has received a number of millions of dollars over the last 10 years because of some of the changes we've made to the Alaska Trust statutes. And from what I can see, the impact or the cost to the state has been almost nil. I don't think there's been a significant increase in the use of the court system, but it has been advantageous for Alaskans and non-Alaskans.
All right, thank you very much. Seeing no further questions for Mr. Blotmacher, we'll go to Jim Plymire of Wells Fargo.
Chairman, this is Doug Blotmacher again. We just got an email from him saying that he had to leave at 1:30.
All right. Is it Janet or
Janet Ridge? Both signed off too.
Oh, apparently several people have signed off. I believe we may be down to Jonathan. Is there a, are there a Douglas and a Jonathan Blotmacher? I have on a list here, is there a Jonathan? All right, is there anyone off-site that we have not heard testimony from that would like to provide public testimony? Hearing none, is there anyone present in the audience today? Hearing none, we'll close public testimony. Mr. Fulton. Chairman,
if I may, I just wanted to point out that there is a committee substitute before the committee today. We are asking that version Echo be adopted, and I can I'd be happy to explain the changes between the version as introduced and the committee substitute that's before you today, if you like. I can give you a brief summary. There's 12 or 13 changes there. Did that make it into the committee packet?
Yeah. It's just behind the sectional analysis.
The work draft?
Yeah.
Okay, I have...
nothing but the work draft.
Have a...
It's LS, or 26-LS0302/E. Oh, yeah.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
There, Senator Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, I move CS or Senate Bill number 60/E for the committee.
Any objections? Hearing none, we have the committee substitute for Senate Bill 60 before the committee. Are all senators up to date and where we're at on that? What's the thoughts of any discussion or observations of the committee with respect to Senate Bill 60?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Bundy.
I'd like to hear if there are any substantial differences between the CS and the original bill. I mean, I don't know why we talked about the original bill when we had a CS, but in any case, we could hear the differences.
Mr. Fulton, would you please go through the modifications or adjustments?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. Just to give a quick summary, basically what these came out of continued conversation between Mr. Shaftel and our own Terry Bannister over a couple of weeks. And even though there's about 13 changes there, a couple of them, I would say, are substantive. The rest are all conforming changes. And again, I think Mr. Shaftel would be more accurately able to describe those changes. I'm happy to walk you through them. But if we have any questions, we'll probably want to direct them towards Mr. Shaftel. And before everybody, there should be a identification of changes between the original version and the version we have before us now. I believe that made it in the committee packet. In Section 1, we changed some language. Basically, we replaced represent or bind with represent and bind. Section 2, the decedent replaces self. Section 3, no change there. Section 4.
If you could identify the, do you have page and line so that we can track you?
I actually wasn't prepared to present in that way, Mr. Chairman, but I could make an attempt. It just might slow things down a little bit.
Just so that we can, the more easily we can follow you, I think the more efficient we will be.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. And again, in Section 1, page 2, in line... Actually, Actually, I'm going to have to back up there, Mr. Chairman. I think this is going to be a little too onerous if I walk you through each line change. I'd be very happy to.
If you could at least identify the major, in other words, I understand it changed represent or bind to represent and bind, which I agree with that. So just kind of, if you could go through the concepts of the changes.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And again, I think Mr. Schaftel would be better equipped to explain those changes if we don't mind having him walk us through.
Mr. Schaftel, are you still here?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And really, there's only one substantive change between these two. The rest of these are technical. I think Representative Bundy asked before about Section 2, for example, and that's where we had a typographical error existing in present law. And we caught that when we went over the first version of the bill, and so we put in the term the decedent instead of the term self that was in existing law. It was, in going earlier, Section 1, Mr. Chairman, as you point out, the concept is that you represent and bind. When you are this designated representative, you don't represent or bind. So again, this was a typo that crept into the original draft of the bill. We caught it, and that was changed. The only substantive change really was the venue change that we added, already discussed, that's in Section 9. That one was added to the bill at that point because we found that our venue statute was really inadequate to cover venue for a non-resident. And so that provision was added, but that was one that we've, of course, talked about today. That's the only substantive change between these two bills.
Are there any questions of Mr. Schaftel as to the modification that led to the CS that's before us on Senate Bill 60? Thank you very much, Mr. Schaftel, for that explanation. I think that's satisfactory in my mind anyway, so I think I understand what was accomplished, and so thank you very much. Anyone else here present or online that would care to comment to the committee substitute to Senate Bill 60? Seeing none, we will now again close public testimony as to the CS to Senate Bill 60. Does the committee have any discussion that they would like to have as to any part of this? Mr. Fulton, hopefully we have no more questions, but we understand that. Seeing Senator Meyer.
I do have a question. I'm looking at the back of the bill. This will require 2/3 vote. Is that correct? When it goes to the floor?
Senator Meyer, through the chair. And we're referring to lines?
The Section 12. Line
23 through 26. And Senator Pascavant, if you don't mind, I'm going to refer that again to, I'm fairly certain that Teresa Bannister and Dave Schaftel had a conversation about this section, if we don't mind referring that again to him.
Sure. Mr. Schaftel, are you still with us, hopefully?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Representative Meyer.
Senator Meyer, please. He's upgraded last election.
Forgive me, Senator Meyer, through the chair. Yes, my understanding is because this is a venue provision, and it also has a result of affecting the rules of the court, that it does require a two-thirds vote.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
What? Let's see. What's the effective date on this, then? I guess just 90 days after the governor signs?
Through the chair, we didn't request a specific effective okay. date.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Fulton. I believe that, as I stated earlier when we began this hearing, it was my intent to hold it. You know, we think there's a lot of people that are still on the committee. They're still thinking about the various components of this bill, so I think it's appropriate that we hold on to it for the moment and give people the opportunity to think about it and see whether there may be any need for further questioning. So unless there's any other, the will of the committee is that we do something else today. Given that, we'll hold Senate Bill 60 for the moment and we'll address that soon under bills previously heard. And thank you, Mr. Fulton, for your assistance. We now will, it's approximately 2:30, so I think it'd be appropriate that we bring Senate Bill 149 relating to mortgage lending. If you would please, and I understand that we have please identify yourself and state your affiliation.
For the record, Tyson Fick, Legislative Liaison, Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. And thank you for bringing back up Senate Bill 145. And sorry for the late arrival of the committee substitute. It's been the result of a lot of ongoing discussions with the sponsor, other members of the legislature, industry representatives, interest groups, Department of Law, and the Division of Banking and Securities, especially Director Lori Hovanec. Just to very briefly summarize what's going on with the CS, we started off with a shortened bill that would take large portions of our current mortgage licensing statute and put it into regulation that would then be in compliance with the Federal SAFE Act, the Secure and Fair Enforcement for Mortgage Licensing, which was enacted and signed about a month after our mortgage licensing bill went into effect. All the parties involved at this point agree that the bill really is kind of time essential, and we agree on where we want to get to, which is federal compliance, especially with the national database and some of the provisions that we'd have to go through. To walk through the specifics of the bill, Lori was not able to make it here. Hopefully she's online.
Yes, she is.
Talk us through the rest of what we have going on here.
Senator Bundy.
Yeah, you'd mentioned 145. This is 149.
Sorry, 149.
And we are addressing the CS. Is that correct?
I would hope so.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
With that in mind, do we need to adopt the CS for Senate Bill 149, which is version / E, for purposes of review and.
Yes, the motion to bring the CS for Senate Bill 149 / E before the committee. Is there any objection? Seeing none, we do have the committee substitute for Senate Bill 149 / E before the committee. And thank you for reminding us of doing that. And we do have Lori Hovanec on the phone. Are you available?
Yes, Senator Pasquin, I'm here.
All right. Would you, you know, we did start out initially with a short Senate bill, and now we have something other than a short bill. And we did just receive that not too long ago, so I'm sure the committee members have not had the opportunity to go through it in the detail that they would like. And so, but at the same time, if you would please kind of provide us with, you know, take this opportunity to provide the information that we need to analyze this bill while we go through the committee substitute.
Yes, for the record, this is Lori Hovanek, Director of the Division of Banking and Securities, and Senator Pasquin, I'm delighted to do that. I was available over the weekend and worked with Terry Bannister, who had some questions as she drafted this committee substitute, and then received the committee substitute myself yesterday, and have been up most of the night and put together sectional analyses for you. I don't know if you've received the sectional analysis, if the committee members have received that or not yet, but that certainly will be provided. And in doing the sectional analysis of the committee substitute bill, I truly read it through very carefully a number of times, and I'm very happy with the resultant language and provisions that were added to Senate Bill 149.
Just for purposes, we have not yet received the sectional analysis, so I've not been able to distribute that. So just so you're aware of that.
Okay, great. I'm certainly not going to go through summarize.
Apparently, if I could interject one more time, Mr. Fick apparently has sectional analysis, and it's being distributed as you speak. So we're trying to get up to speed as quickly as possible, but just we have now received it.
Excellent. And I tried to be to make it as easy for you as possible to see, look at the language and the analysis to the left, so you can kind of read down the sectional analysis and see what we've added back in, rather than just having the granting of general authority to create regulations to regulate mortgage lending, which is in section 010 on page 1. At your direction, we have added in a lot of the nuts and bolts of our, not only of our current statute, but those requirements of the Federal SAFE Act and model language, which we're required to include. And that our statute, our current mortgage lending statute, must be in compliance with. If you look through the substitute, you'll see that we've added various sections, background checks, investigation. We've added in the educational requirements, testing requirements. Issuance of a license, information about duration and renewal of license, standards for license renewal, continuing education requirements, surrender of license, some of the licensee obligations, records that mortgage licensees are required to keep, disciplinary actions that the division has available. On to page 7, the investigation and examination authority outlined in detail. Action on duties and restrictions, Article 5, and prohibited activities, most of which is taken from current law. However, in the additional notes, you'll see that a few items were added from the SAFE Act. Items 3 through 15 are new. added in more specifics on criminal penalties, civil penalties, addressing unfair trade practices. The surety fund was already in the short bill. I hope that my turning of the pages here isn't creating a lot of noise for you. I apologize.
just a little.
Okay, I'll try to be turn more carefully, more quietly.
You know, one of the questions that I have is, are there time requirements for this that are appropriate for this committee to consider?
Yes, there are. And the federal statutes require that we have something enacted, that we have a law enacted that's compliant with the federal statutes by July 30th of this year. And we also have to have the authority from the legislature to join the National Mortgage Licensing System and Registry so that we can start licensing mortgage loan originators and registering others through the National Mortgage Licensing System. And we're scheduled to join with that system on August 1st. So a portion of the that was added on the very last page, section 13, we've included additional language that so that certain portions of the statute take effect July 30th of this year, which allow us to do those things, to join the mortgage licensing system and pay the $50,000 one-time fee that's required to participate.
Thank you. There's a question by Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you. Earlier this year, there was quite a backup where, under our law, where people were trying to get licensed. Have we provided for enough lead time for people to get licensed in a timely fashion now that they have to be licensed on the federal level?
Yes, there is. In fact, current licensees have even more time than a brand new applicant who will be seeking a license. So I think the way the statute's written is very fair.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Lori Hovanec or any other comments? I know that there are a number of other people that would like to testify, so please, if you could stay on the line and available, there may be additional questions, but understand there may be a Patrice Walsh. If we had questions for her, she's an examiner with the Division of Budget and Securities. Patrice, are you?
Yes, I'm present. I work with Director Hovanec, so I'm here to answer any questions if you have them.
All right, any questions of Ms. Walsh? Seeing none, we'll move.
Chairman?
Yes, Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lengthy explanation of the bill here, longer than the original bill, the sectional analysis is. The question, I guess, is there anything in this bill that corrects, if it has not already been corrected, the issues that arose last year or the year before with countrywide when they were licensing people as insurance agents or some aspect of their business and not licensing them to do other things, but they were doing mortgage lending and other type of lending as well. Is there anything in this bill, if you're familiar with that problem, that is addressed here?
Through the chair, I'm not entirely familiar with that issue. So there's someone here who may have some information, though, who's available to testify.
Who would that person be? Are they available?
That's John Martin.
He's the next person on the list, so
okay.
Mr. John Martin, please identify yourself, state your affiliation, and if you may, please answer Senator Thomas's question.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. In regards to that question, there were some entities under current law that were exempt from from being licensed under Alaska law, and Countrywide ended up becoming a bank. So under federal regulations, they were exempt from our current 0660. They would have to apply for an exemption for that, and I don't know that they have, or some of the other banks as well.
Just
if you got any more questions on that issue?
Yeah, for purposes of identification, please state your name and your affiliation.
Okay, sure.
So.
Okay. My name is John Martin. I'm a mortgage licensee and originator licensee under our current 0660 mortgage licensing law. I'm also the past legislative chair and current president of the Alaska Association of Mortgage Brokers, an affiliate of the National Association of Mortgage Brokers. The Alaska Mortgage Brokers, along with the Alaska Mortgage Bankers Association, were instrumental and heavily involved in the creation of our existing statute, 0660. It took 2 years of concentrated work and tremendous support from others in the industry to work for a great law that raised the standards of the industry and provided for consumer protection. We all worked very closely with the Division of Banking to achieve this goal. Both the House and the Senate unanimously passed the final bill. This was a bill that was brought forth by industry. By way of additional background, Congress enacted the SAFE Act as part of the Housing and Recovery Act of 2008 that ultimately became Public Law 110-289, and that's why the current bill is before you. Under that legislation, generally states are free to regard the requirements of the SAFE Act as a floor, not a ceiling, which they may build on in enacting their own licensing and registration laws. The SAFE Act encourages states to establish a national mortgage licensing system and registry to be developed and maintained by the Conference of State Bank Supervisors and the American Association of Residential Mortgage Regulators. Alaska signed a letter of intent to join the organization on August 1, 2009, and you can see the press release dated October 21st, 2008 on the Department of Commerce website. Notably, it's intended to streamline the licensing process and reduce the regulatory burden. While the states must meet the federal requirements of SAFE, overall responsibility for interpretation, implementation, and compliance with SAFE rests with HUD under Section 1508 of Public Law 110-289. HUD must implement a backup system and administer its own licensing and registration requirements in those states where a state law does not meet the requirements of SAFE. Title V of the Act for mortgage licensing affirms that any residential mortgage loan originator must be either state licensed by August 1, 2009 or registered. Under Section 1508, HUD must determine if the state has met the requirements of Section 1505, 1506, and subsection D of Section 1508, or does not participate in the National Mortgage Licensing System and Registry. I was in Washington, D.C. about a month ago and attended a roundtable discussion of the many regulatory changes taking place on the federal level. Bill Machinier, a staff attorney for HUD, was on that panel. I asked him, how in the world did they expect all 50 states to comply with SAFE by August 1? I tell you what, he's thankful that the SAFE Act provided.
Hello. Did we lose? I think
the volcano erupted.
We were just going to get how all 50 states could comply. Apparently, they can't.
Yeah. So, I think he was getting towards the potential for an extension with HUD.
We'll. Is there anyone online telephonically? I think we've lost all off-site. I know that there's a Luann Wyrock. Are you to answer questions or?
I'm here to answer questions, yes.
All right. I know we had also a Julia Koster. Okay. Do we want to use this? Well, can you record us? Yeah. We'll take a brief at ease and we'll see technically where we're at. To order, we appear to have solved our technical issues. Mr. Martin, we apologize for the technological problems, but in mid-sentence we lost you, and you were just at the point where you were going to explain your meeting with the HUD individual as to how all 50 states could hopefully comply.
Okay, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was in Washington, D.C. a month ago and attended a roundtable discussion of the many regulatory changes taking place on the federal level. Bill Machinier, a staff attorney for HUD, was on that panel, and I asked him how in the world they could expect all 50 states to comply with SAFE by August 1st of this year. I tell you, he was very thankful that the SAFE Act provided for an opportunity for a waiver for the states. HUD's involvement was mandated by the SAFE Act, but no funds were provided for it. Under the SAFE Act, HUD can grant a waiver up to 12 to 24 months for states that show a good faith effort to comply with the Act. With our existing law and joining the NMLSR, we will be in compliance to get a waiver. The sponsor statement and some of the talking points supplied with the bill allude to the fact that we're going to need to get a waiver. The CSBS website shows 40 states working on the legislation and that just 9 have enacted legislation so far. NAM is just now gathering data from the 50 states to see how many have complied with SAFE, and more information will be coming in the future. Our current statute, 0660, substantially conforms to the SAFE Act. In fact, I think they looked at our statute and used many of our ideas. Some changes will be needed to be made to our Act to comply with SAFE. Paragraph 5 of the above-mentioned press release states that the Alaska Mortgage Lending Act will need to be revised slightly to comply with the new requirements under the federal law. Well, that has changed as they want to just scrap that law entirely and come in with a new statute and substantially bring in a lot of the language that we had before. Last Friday, the Alaska Association of Mortgage Brokers and the Alaska Mortgage Bankers Association met with the Division of Director of Banking and Securities, Lori Levanik, to discuss this legislation. In concept, we agreed the changes were necessary to the bill. The effect is the new CS now has, by the committee, been adopted. Industry wants to work with the state on this legislation, but because we have not had an opportunity to meet and discuss this new CS, we ask that the committee please hold the bill so that if any changes are needed, we can get them done and move the bill forward in both houses and get it done this year. Both associations want to come up with a mutual solution on the subject. In fact, we all do. We want to be able to present a solution that can be processed by the House and Senate at the same time without being bounced back and forth between committees and chambers. We understand that we now have a shortened legislative session and want to make the most effective use of its time in this matter. Thank you for your attention and consideration on the subject. I'm available for your questions at this time.
Do you know when you would have your answers regarding the your committee's review of the CS?
Mr. Chairman, I was aware that the new CS came out this morning. I sent out an email before I left the office at lunch to my compadres in the industry to see when we can meet. Hopefully we can in a few days, but until I get a response, I can't tell you. And I did CC Lori Hovannik on it as well.
You know, we really are down to just a limited number of days that this committee will be meeting, and it may be later this week and next week, and then we are going to be beyond our capacity to move the bill. So I would suggest prompt action.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman, and that is my intent to get everybody motivated to do that, but I can't speak for everyone just at this time yet.
Yes, and I am in agreement with you as far as our holding the bill until you've had the opportunity to engage in your process. So the sooner the better, so that we can get it back here and this committee can consider it, and then it has to go from here to the Finance Committee. And so we have a lot to get done in really what's less than 3 weeks now, and probably a week and a half to have it heard by this committee and the next committee, or else it's going to be out of time. So with that, I would, Lou Ann Wyrock, would you care to come forward, or is this, would you just as soon wait until after Mr. Martins has reviewed the CS?
For the record, I'm Lou Ann Wyrock. I'm an assistant AG in the Department of Law representing the Division of Banking and Securities. It makes sense probably for me to reserve any comments until we've worked through the process more, but I'd be glad to take any questions today.
Does anyone have any questions? I know that there's also a Julia Coster. I assume possibly this.
Julia Coster is also an assistant AG who works in the Consumer Protection Division of the Department of Law. She's available in the Anchorage office now to answer questions also.
All right. Are there any questions from either the Banking Division or the Consumer Protection Division of the Department of Law as to this? Senator Bundy?
Well, to both the representatives, from their perspective in the administration, do they support in concept these changes? All right, we're kind of like we don't have many choices, but at least are you?
I would defer on the consumer protection issue to Julia Coster.
Yeah. Julia, are you available?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Julia Coster, and I'm with the Department of Law, Office of the Attorney General in the Consumer Protection Unit. And we do have one issue that we wanted to raise to the committee that related to a provision. It's actually a very small provision in the very near the very end of the bill, Section 9, and it's a repeal of AS 4550, 471, D52. This section refers specifically to the Consumer Protection Act, and the provision B-52 makes a violation of the Mortgage Lending Act a violation of the Consumer Protection Act, and this section is being repealed. We don't necessarily object to the repeal of this section, but we do have a concern that we were hoping that the committee would be able to address by considering and adopting a letter of intent relating to this repeal. And if you would like to, I can go into the reasons why. I'm not sure if you have a copy of our proposed letter of intent in your committee file.
I believe the answer is no. For the committee members, I believe under the CS, we're looking at page 35, line 10, where in part it is repealing AS 4550, 471, B52. And as I understand, Ms. Koster, that is part of the Consumer or the Unfair Trade Practices Act?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that is a provision in the very first section of the Consumer Protection Act, which discusses what an unfair deceptive act or practice is. And it might be profitable to, until you have the language of the letter of intent in front of you, it might be, if the bill is going to be held over anyway, it might be good to wait until we have the language of the letter of intent in front of you, and then I can address the specifics of why we would appreciate if you would consider adopting this letter of intent and why it's necessary.
I agree with you, especially in the sense that it's almost 3 o'clock, and I would invite both you and Ms. Wyrock to come back when we do hear this bill again, if this information can be distributed to us so that we now have the CS and we have a lot of reading of the sectional analysis in the bill itself, and whatever we can get as soon as possible would be much appreciated by the committee, I'm sure. So given that, we will hold Senate Bill 149 for the day. Is there any questions or comments by any committee member? Hearing none, the meeting for today is adjourned.